They gave us because we might think that inasmuch he was not originally invited to eat, he was only there in order to serve, but was not invited to Saturday, so that therefore we should say that he shouldn't be counted to the Mizumin. So the answer is not, the contrary is. Now we come to the case of the next thing mentioned in the Mishnah, which is Hakusi. All right?
Hakusi. Remember we had Hakusi in
yes.
the last chapter of Kiddushin when we studied it a couple of years ago, when, you know, Asura Yuchsin Olam Bovel, if you remember, and we were trying to determine the yichus of each one and so on, are they permitted to marry right. into the Jewish fold and so on. And at that time we defined historically who were the Kusim, okay? The Kusim, if you remember again, to refresh your memory, they were people who were originally brought from the far ends of the Assyrian Empire. The Assyrians were the, you know, one of the early world empires. They had conquered much of the Near East, okay? Until finally they were in turn conquered by Babylonia. But they were there on the scene before Babylonia became a world power, okay? The Assyrians had a policy that after they had conquered a territory, they wanted to destroy whatever native attachments there might be among the conquered population and their land. So instead of permitting them to remain in the land, simply subject, let's say, to Assyrian sovereignty, their policy was to take the captured population and then send them out into exile into the furthest reaches of the Assyrian Empire, so that eventually they would be lost among them, and you know they would no longer have any attachments or any hope of ever getting back to their native land. Now this is what happened. This was the policy that they followed after they conquered the 10 tribes of Israel, the kingdom of Israel. Remember that the Jewish people were, after the reign of King Solomon, during the reign of his son Rehoboam, or Rehoboam, we call him in English, they were split into two kingdoms. You had the kingdom of Yisrael, Malchus Yisrael, or also called Malchus Ephraim, and then those two tribes, Yehuda and Binyamin, that remained loyal to the Malchut Beit David, to the dynasty of King David, and they still remained loyal to having Yerushalayim as their capital, and so on. Okay, so we now had two nations existing side by side, two Jewish nations, but of course each one different from each other. Now the kingdom of Israel was conquered by the Assyrians. After they had conquered them, I'm sort of running ahead of myself for a moment, they also then began their campaign against Yehuda, Malchut Yehuda. And as a matter of fact, they approached Yerushalayim, and it seemed that the fall of Yerushalayim was also imminent. At this time, the king happened to be Sancher, or Sennacherib, we call him in English. And then a miracle was performed by the Ribbono Shel Olam, and the Assyrian army suddenly turned tail and they fled. They had heard rumors, as a matter of fact, that it probably was based on the true rumor, that there was a revolution back in Nineveh, the capital, and so the troops were withdrawn. They ran back, and as a result, Yerushalayim was spared for approximately maybe about 50 years or something like that, until finally it fell to the Babylonians. Okay, well, it's a little bit more than that. 701, pardon me, right, it's a little over a century, correct. Okay, I didn't check my chronology, I'm relying sometimes over here. Okay, but at any rate, getting back to their policy, they took the people of Israel, the 10 tribes, and they scattered them all over the Assyrian Empire, so that to this day we don't know where they are. This, of course, is the reason why we speak about the 10 lost tribes of Israel, right? And of course, all kinds of stories arose how they're in some far off place and still in existence someplace. And there's a river Sambatyon that separates them, and this river is a stormy river, nobody can cross it. Only on Shabbos, does it come to rest, and that's why it's called Sambatyon, because on Shabbos it rests. But if it's not Shabbos, then it keeps on storming, And that's why we were never able to find them. And from time to time, people have said that either they are descendants of the 10 tribes or that they have found the 10 tribes and so on. But of course, we don't have any definite evidence of that effect. Now, what did the Assyrians do with all this land? What we would call Samaria today, and Ephraim, and so forth. What did they do with it? The answer is that they brought in people from Machlach and Chavor and who knows from other places, you know, that they schlepped them in from different areas in the...
Resettled some of their own people.
And they settled them in Israel, okay? Now, not every Jew actually was driven out of Israel. There were still handfuls of Jews that remained here and there in northern Israel, I'm talking about, okay? But these people came in and they settled among them. And then the Bible tells us that something very interesting happened. There was a plague of lions that suddenly began to attack over there. And when this happened, so these people, by the way, Kusa is one of the places where they came from. That's why we call them Kusa, okay? It's also one of the territories conquered, okay? So these people, when they saw the lions, you know, beginning to take a toll, so they became afraid and they decided that maybe the God of Israel was punishing them. So the result was that they decided to mingle with whatever Jews there were, and they created a religion which was partly Jewish, and partly they still held on, you know, to some of their old customs and so on. Right. Now, these people were also called Shomronim, or Samaritans, because Shomron was the capital of Malchus Ephraim, okay? And these people, during the time when the people of Israel came back, you know, from Babylonian exile, of course, now I'm talking about a later period, they wanted to be considered as full-fledged Jews. But, as we learned from Gomorrah, you know, in Kedushin, they bring in other places and so on, the Jews were very suspicious of them. They felt that there's still too much idolatry in their own religion. According to one story, they worshipped a Yonah, a dove that they saw, you know, coming out, so that they, you know, that they still had religious symbols which were not Jewish, okay? And the result is that Jews did not accept them as full Jews. Nevertheless, these people also considered themselves as Jews, just as the Samaritans do to this very day, okay? They have a handful of them left in Eretz Israel, you know. They live generally in the area around Har Gerizim, which is around the city of Shechem, or Nablus, as they call it. Big center of Arab
unrest,
right. And every year, they still celebrate their Pesach by going up on Mount Gerizim, and that they sacrifice a paschal lamb over there, and they have an old copy of the Torah written in funny letters. We call it the Samaritan Torah and so on, that they abide by. All right, but as I said, in their own eyes, they were very good Jews. So now the question is, can a Kusi, if he sat down with two full-fledged Jews, so to speak, be counted to him as well? This is what the Mishnah wants to know. And the Mishnah said, yes. The Hakusi Mizaminola, right? That's what the Mishnah says. So now the Gemara asks a logical question. Am I? Why? Why should we count him to a Mizumin? Lo Yehe Elam Ha'oretz. Why is he any better than an Am Ha'oretz? Now, this is something that we're going to have to define. What is an Am Ha'oretz? Okay? If I would ask you, an Am Ha'oretz, you know, give me a definition.
Usually it's referred to as an ignorant person.
An ignorant person, right. This is the way we look upon it.
Not really truly observant.
Yeah, well, a person could be ignorant and still observant, you know, to the best of his ability, you see. We have different expressions. I mean, for example, in Pirkei Avos, you may remember the Mishnah which says, Ein Bor, what does it say again? Yeah. Ein bo yirei chet v'lam ha'oretz chosid. Right. Ein bo yirei chet v'lam ha'oretz chosid. That a boor, and what do we say a boor? A boor is a person who is empty, doesn't have much learning or knowledge or anything like that. So he cannot be truly God-fearing because he doesn't understand what it means, you know, to full extent what it means to be God-fearing. But Le'amoritz Chosid and Le'amoritz cannot be truly pious. But nevertheless, you know, he could observe. So the question that the Gemara is raising right now is, how is the Kusi any better that we say that the Kusi can be counted Mezumen, whereas we have a Beraisa, which we're going to quote right now, which says that we do not invite a Kusi, we do not invite an Amor Oretz to be part of a Mezumen. Okay? So therefore, first of all, let's take a look at this Beraisa, and then let's see how they define the word Amor Oretz. Not exactly the definition that we would give today, and they don't give every definition of Amporetz either. Okay. Alright, so the Tanya, we have learned the Baraisa which says Ein Mizamnim al Amporetz, that we are not permitted to include an Amporetz in the Zimun, you know, among those who join the Mizum. Okay, that's what the Baraisa says. So now it's not written at the moment who is actually the author of this particular Baraisa, right, this particular teaching. And secondly, as it was discussed, you know, in the next generation or by the later authorities, so each one tried to give, you know, a different definition. So the first one is Abaye Omar. So Abaye says, we're not talking about the ordinary Kusi when we say that the Kusi can be included and the Amoritz, no, but we're talking about a special type of a Kusi. Who is this? The Kusi Chover. Question is, what do we mean by the word Chover over here? Chover here means, doesn't mean pal or friend, but Chover means somebody who has learned it in Torah. This is the meaning of it. So, if you have a Kusi who has learned it in Torah, then in that particular case, you can count him, because you can be sure that, you know, he knows what the laws are all about, and so on and so forth, and you have to have respect for his learning, okay? So he can be counted, okay? Rav Omar, usually Sabai and Rav are always arguing with each other, so Rav has a different, he says, Afilu teimam b'kusi amoret. He says, no, I would say that we can even include a kusi who is an amoret, but what kind of an Amhoretz are we talking about? So he says, Hocho, here where the Baraisa says that we do not include in the Mizumen, it's the Amhoretz, the Rabbonon. That this is an Amhoretz who was declared so by our sages. Torah doesn't say that he's an Amhoretz, by the way. In the Torah, I have to tell you, in the Torah itself, Amhoretz means literally what it says. In other words, the people of the land. In other words, the good to Eden.
Yeah.
It's also Amhoretz. I mean, where it's written Amhoretz, you can move a oven, for example. It refers to good, substantial citizens and so on. And this is the way it continued throughout almost all of the books of the Tanakh that were the expression Amhoretz. For example, you take Yecheskel, okay? Yecheskel Anovi. He has a chapter that happens to be the Haftarah for Shabbos Hagadol. Okay, begin not Shabbos Hagadol, but Shabbos Parshas Achodesh. Right, so call Amhoretz, Yola Trumor, so on and so forth. All right, there he means Amhoretz in a very respectful fashion, meaning, you know, leading Jewish people and so on and so forth. So as you can see, there in the Tanakh, the word does not have this pejorative meaning. It's a respectful thing. Okay. A book was written maybe about 100 years ago in America by George Meyer Sulzberger. I don't know if you ever heard of him. Sulzberger was an American justice, and you know, he liked to dabble in Jewish inyanim, so he wrote a book which is called The Amhoretz, okay? In which he speaks as this being like a democratic assembly of the Jewish people, a parliament of the Jewish people. Why am I quoting it? Because of the fact, as you can see, that the word Amhoretz to begin with did not have a bad meaning. On the contrary, it was highly complimentary in nature. But for the first time, when you get to the last books, Ezra and Nehemiah, there we find already that Amhoretz refers to not Eden, but it refers to Goyim. Not Jews, but Goyim, okay? So since we find the reference to Goyim over there, and then the expression Amhoretz, then it means that by that time, in other words, after the beginning of the second Commonwealth, you know, the Kufas HaBayis HaSheni, as we would say, you know, the period of the Second Temple. So this term had already begun to change, so that to some Eden, then the word Am HaOretz already signifies a Pshtikul Goy. Okay? So, getting back to this, therefore, the Am HaOretz, he says that we're talking about the Am HaOretz Dirabbanan. In other words, an Am HaOretz as defined by the rabbis. Okay. The Pligei Alei, the Rabbi Meir. Okay. Well, arguing, right, first of all, they are in disagreement with Rabbi Meir. Askinim, this is what we're dealing with. The Tanya, who, because Rabbi Meir learned as follows. He learned, Eizehu Am HaOretz. How do we define the word Am HaOretz? He says, Kol She'enu Ochel Kulo V'Tara, Divrei Rabbi Meir. All right, this we have to understand. Rabbi Meir is talking here about a practice that we find with the Prushim, the Pharisees, okay? Or they prefer to consider themselves very Chaverim, okay? Now, they were very meticulous about the food that they ate. According to the law of the Torah, when do we have to observe Tahara? By Tahara I mean, you know, that you have to eat, your foods have to be in 100% state of cleanliness, if you wish, but purity is a better word than, okay? And the kalim that you use, in other words, the pots, the pans, the knives, the forks, whatever you use, has to be in the state of Tahara and so on. So, according to the law of the Torah, this is only with what we call kosher. In other words, those things which are being eaten in the Beis HaMikdosh or Yerushalayim, or like Truma, which could be eaten anywhere by the Kohen, but he had to be in the state of purity in order to eat it. Okay? What do I mean by state of purity? He had to make sure, first of all, that he had toveled in a mikveh. Okay? And also, that, as I said before, all the preparations and everything, you know, had been done in the state of Tahara. Okay? Because if, for example, there had been even the slightest contact with a dead corpse or with a sheretz, a creeping creature or something like that, then automatically it made it tummy, which is the opposite of tahir, okay? It made it tummy. And therefore, any food which had been contaminated in this way could not be eaten by, a Jew who was eating kosher. All right. Now, what did the Prushim do? Prushim came along and they extended that not only to Kachim, but they also extended the same law to Cholin. Cholin means ordinary food, not Kachim, okay? For example, we have a whole Masechta Cholin, which deals in a large part with laws of, kashrus. But what kind of laws are they dealing with over there? Not the laws of, let's say the animals of the Bodhis Kobonis of Beis HaMikdash, for that we have other tractates that deal with it, like Zvochim and so on and so forth, okay? But we're dealing with ordinary food, right? And, the difference between Pleshiks and Milchigs and the proper Shechita and, what part of the animal, the draining of the blood and so on and so forth, okay? This is what Chulin deals with. But it applies to ordinary food that ordinary people ate. Now, the Prushim ate their chulin, in other words, their ordinary food, as if they were eating kachim, in other words, in the state of tahara. They were very careful about the pots, the pans, and so on, very careful that it should not become rendered impure in any way, and so on. So, Rabbi Meir now gives a classic definition of the Am HaOretz, and that is that he says that an Am HaOretz is anybody who does not observe this rule of eating chulin in a state of tahara, which would mean that the average person would be an Am HaOretz according to Rabbi Meir's definition, because not everybody is so careful. Of course, now that we don't have all these rules and regulations, we're a little removed from it. But nevertheless, the Gemara again and again, they refer to Tumah, Tahara. It's a very complicated Indian, I don't have to tell you that. And, you know, people were very, very careful in their observance about Tumah Tahara. All right. So this is his definition. Am Ha'aretz is the opposite of a Chover, right? The Am Ha'aretz, we suspect, doesn't take care about eating his food in Tahara, whereas the Chover does. So he's an Am Ha'aretz. But the sages disagree. They give a different definition. They say, Kol she'inu ma'aser perosav kara'ui. They say an Am Ha'aretz is somebody who doesn't give the tithes exactly the way he should. Now, they don't say he doesn't give tithes at all, because they recognize that even Rov Am Ha'aretz, we say, were careful to observe most of the laws of Miser. Okay? They were careful. But to do it, you know, 100%, they were not that careful that they did it 100%. Okay? So therefore, they say that whoever does not give Miser of his fruits as he should, in other words, you know, 100%, according to all the rules and regulations and so on, so he is an Am Ha'aretz. Okay. The Hani Kusai, and what about the Kusim? They say, Asiri Ma'asrei Kedekhozi. They actually give their tithes in the right way. In other words, they're very careful, they're very scrupulous about how they give their tithes. Because the Kusim are very, very careful about what is written in the Torah. In other words, the Kusim have accepted upon themselves to observe faithfully the teachings of the Torah. What don't they observe? They don't observe the laws of the Rabbanan, you see. I mean, all the oral tradition, in other words, the Torah Shebaal Peh, we would say, this they don't accept. They only accept the authority of the Torah Shebaal. That's it. So that therefore, since tithes are mentioned in the Torah, so they are very scrupulous about the observance of them. So that therefore, if they are careful and they're doing it, so in that particular case, this is the reason why we can count them to the Mitzumin and not the Am Ha'aretz, who we suspect did not give tithes the way they're supposed to give. Okay. So we've solved that particular problem, why the Kusi was singled out. And the poor Eden who were Am Ha'aretz, they were not. Okay. Now, how do we know that they do that? So we say, yeah, the Maizid Sivil Raisam Yisrael, they're very careful about what's written in the Torah. The Omar Mar, as one of our authority said, Kol Mitzvah, it's a very famous statement, by the way, Kol Mitzvah Shechazikah Bo Kusim Harbei Medaktikim Bo Yisrael Yisrael, that any mitzvah that the Kusim have retained, in other words, that they hold on to, they observe, then they are even more careful in its observance than the ordinary Israelite is. Okay? Mm-hmm. So if that's the case, maybe we have to come to other definitions of the word Am Ha'aretz. So Tana Rabbanan. So now we have another definition given to us about an Am Ha'aretz. Okay? Ezehu Am Ha'aretz. How do we define an Am Ha'aretz? So it says, Kol she'eino kore kriya shema, arbis v'shachus divrei Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Eliezer says, if a person doesn't recite krishma morning and night, then he's an Am Ha'aretz. No, that's something we can all understand. Yeah, after all, an ordinary Jew should at least be able to recite Krishna in the morning and the night. We're not asking him to sit down and learn a blot kibar at this point. But at least daven and say Krishna. This you can do. All right, so anybody who doesn't observe that, according to Rabbi Eliezer, is to be considered Am Ha'aretz. Rabbi Yehoshua Omer, Rabbi Yehoshua gives a definition. He says, Kol she'einu maniach tefillin. Says, anybody who does not put on tefillin is an Am Ha'aretz. No, God preserve us. Unfortunately, I can show other shuls in this community where even when they come to Minyan, you know, they don't put on tefillin over there. So I guess you have to say that's to use the terminology of Pirkei Avos again, it's Botek and Aseo Shalom Ha'aretz. These are the shuls of Amoratzim.
Amoratzim.
All right. Thank God and Kadim, at least people do put on tefillin. I'll thank God. Okay.
Okay.
All right, so this is his definition, Rabbi Yeshua. He says that anybody who doesn't put on tefillin, this is an Am Ha'aretz. Ben Azai says, Kol she'ein lo tzitzis b'digdo. He says, anybody who doesn't wear tzitzis on his garment, he is an Am Ha'aretz. Of course, tzitzis.
Nothing, no, it's gone, you know, step by step.
Right, right. Each one has his own particular definition, so you can see.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, if you see a progression,
now
we're
in a pavement, you know.
I don't know if it's progression or regression or what.
No, that's something else. No, I'm just joking.
No, we're not talking about pace now. We're talking about the outer compass, okay?
Yes, yes.
I mean, if you wear a garment with four corners, it has to, it's the chuyav, you know, you're obligated to have tzitzis in it. Of course, why do we wear a talus? Why do we wear an outer compass? It's because even though our garments today are not built along those lines, so that technically they are free from the obligation to wear tzitzis, but we don't want a mitzvah to be forgotten. And that's the reason why we put on the talus when we daven, and why we wear an outer compass.
Wear a talus cut?
Yes.
I just wanted to ask you a question.
Sure.
About the Kosim or the Samaritans.
Yeah.
I asked the Yiddish guy.
You were a novelist, yeah.
Yeah, for many years ago. I wanted to ask you, did they, I can't really get a handle on this. Did they do Brit Milah? Did they want to be Giorim, or did they just...
I'm sure that they observed Milah, because Milah is written in the Torah. I mean, God said to Abraham, I mean, you all call Zatarah, right? The Dorotechem, you have to be circumcised throughout your generations. This is the law that applies to eternity for our students. And I remember, they consider themselves Jews.
Well, that was my question.
Yeah, they consider themselves Jews.
Do they want to be...
Yeah. It's only when the
Yarim, did they want to, did they come to be converted to Judaism, or did they just...
Yes, but the rabbis felt that they're Geirut, or Giyur, actually, you know, either term is correct, okay? That it was not full, you know, wholehearted, because if it were wholehearted, they would have thrown away anything, you know, that they were suspected of still observing. That's the reason why there was this feeling, you know, that the Kutiyim, you know, were not really part of the Jewish people. By the way, you know, when they themselves said, you know, that they did not want to be considered like the Zionist Jews or the other, when Jordan ruled over there, during the years between 48 and 67, that, of course, was under the control of Jordan, and they permitted the Shomronim to stay over there. Of course, they said, we're not Jews like those Zionist Jews, you know. We have nothing to do with them. But nevertheless, from our point of view, they are Jews. Just that, you know, we don't accept them, you know, as being as full-fledged as if they had actually undergone a full, you know, full-fledged Giyur. Full-fledged Giyur would mean that you not only agree to observe the laws of the Torah Shebiksav, but also it means that you have to observe as well the Masoret, you know, that has come down to us of the, you know, our rabbis, our sages, our teachers, and so on.
As much the same as the Jews from Ethiopia?
Yeah, with Ethiopia it's a different problem, but still, I mean, essentially this is it. This is why many people thought, you know, that they should be reconverted to Judaism, because of the fear that, first of all, that they did not have many of the traditions that we have. That's number one. And secondly, because there were certain Christological elements, you know, because of their contact, the fact that they were a minority religion in Ethiopia, and the Ethiopians had suppressed them, and in some cases, you know, they had adopted some of the practices of their Christian neighbors, the Coptics, you know, the people who run the Abyssinian Church, okay? So this was the reason why.
Yeah, but
not everybody is united in this feeling about it. In many cases,
why
they feel
they
full
if they
Jews
consider themselves
so
Jews,
right.
So they are
right.
Jews,
right.
They can trace their ancestry,
yeah.
Why should they convert, then be considered a Geyer?
Okay, you raise a legitimate question.
And then, they
and the rabbinate in Eretz Israel was divided about how to react. Some said exactly along the lines that you said, and others said along the lines that I said, that they should go through a formal process of conversion. Of course, today they're being brought up, for the most part, you know, if they go to religious schools, I mean, that they're getting the same religious education that you get in all the religious schools in Eretz Israel. And they're being brought up to observe, and you can go in Yerushalayim and see them with kippot on it and everything
else. Were they
circumcised
and so on?
I guess that they were. I didn't examine them, but I assume that they were.
No, they observed Nero.
No, I'm sure that they observed it. Again, after all, this is biblical. You
but
know.
But if they weren't part of the Talmudic tradition that occurred, you know, after,
yeah.
does that have anything to do with making them full-fledged Jews?
Well, today we would say that they should accept, you know, the same tradition that all of us have accepted. You know, what is Yiddishkeit, okay? What is Judaism? Mm-hmm. So that, and this is what's happening in Eretz Israel. Mm-hmm. Willy-nilly, I mean, they're being, either officially or unofficially, but they're being converted, you know, to our practices, to our traditions and everything else.
There's no resistance in their part?
Yeah, for some of them there's resistance, of course.
But with the Samaritans there has been resistance.
Yeah, but the Samaritans are, there's so few of them. I don't know if there are 100 of them in existence
right now.
Yeah, they're very small.
Yeah.
You had also a handful of what they called Karaites. These are not Samaritans, but they also believe that they would only accept the Torah Shavitah, not the Torah Shavaldeh. Yeah.
I remember reading Eric Kuntz's post about a year ago. Believe it or not, they have about 900 or 1100 in that loose. They also have about 700 or 800 that live at in Holon.
Oh,
all places right in Israel. Okay, I mean, the only problem with them is that they keep sending delegations to the Pope to get money because after all they're good Samaritans. You know? They have a big receptivity in the Vatican.
You know? Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's just
since you're talking about the Good Samaritan, let me just digress for 1 minute, okay? You heard the expression, the Good Samaritan. It's a New Testament story, okay? That, you know, one of the parables of you-know-who, okay? That once upon a time, you know, a poor guy was fallen on the road, and the Kohen came along, and the Kohen refused to do anything because he said he didn't want to become unclean, you know, by touching him. So he went on his way. Then Levi came and he said that he didn't want to do anything either because, again, you know, the same reason. So along came the Samaritan and he was the one, you know, who helped this particular person. That's why they call him the Good Samaritan. Solomon Schechter, many, many years ago, wrote several volumes of essays in Judaism. One of the essays, one of the very interesting ones, happens to be about this particular story. He says, the original story was about the Cain who refused to help, the Levi who refused. Then along came the Israel and he helped. But it didn't, Mishka passed, you know, for the New Testament, that they didn't want to give any good credit to the Jews. So what did they do? So they changed it. They said it was the Samaritan instead. So if you hear the Good Samaritan, remember.
He was your soul.
Of course.
Okay. Getting back over here. All right. Yeah. So each definition, as we see, this guy doesn't put on fillin, this one doesn't put on
tittus.
Now we're up to the next one. Rav Nosson Omer Koshein Mezuzah Pitzchot. Anyone who doesn't even have a mezuzah on his door, he's a non-horus, okay? I don't have to tell you. You know, that it's one thing, many homes, at least, the Jews who otherwise have very little practice, but they still observe by putting mezuzah on the door.
Right.
So I'm afraid that we'll find more and more again of, you know, households that do not carry it. Rabbi Nosson bar Yosef Omer, Kol Sheyesh Lo Bonim, V'Einu Megadlim Talmud Torah. Rav Nosson bar Yosef, he says, anybody who has children and he doesn't raise them to study Torah, this is a non-Torah. Very interesting, this definition. Because now it's not just who he is, but as we see, his generation is also suffering as a result. Acherim omrim, and then there are other authorities, unmentioned, okay, who say, Afilu kora v'shono v'lo shimesh talmidei chachamim. That even if this person is Korah, Korah means that he has studied Torah, okay? Mikra, right? In other words, he studied Torah. Mishonah means that he's even learned Mishnah. In other words, he's also learned, you know, Torah Shebaal Peh, alright? But nevertheless, he did not serve or help out Talmidei Chachamim in the sense that we have a lot of what we learn. We learn not just through formal learning, you know, we study a text, we study a course, whatever it may be, but we also may be a very important aspect of our learning, maybe one of the most important aspects of our learning is what we observe in other people, whether it's in our parents or in our teachers, our rabbis, and so on. And therefore, it is a mitzvah to not only observe them, but to help them whichever way we can. And this is what we call by Shimish Talmidei Chacham. Okay? So he says, even if a person is a scholar, he's learned Torah, and he's learned Mishnah, but he's never taken the trouble to be Mishamish Talmidei Chachamim. In other words, he's only absorbed it formally, without actually getting into, involved, you know, in actually rubbing shoulders and observing and seeing and learning from, you know, other people with their actions and so on and so forth. So he's an Amhoritz. Harei Zeh Amhoritz, he says. Omer Rav Huna, and Rav Huna said, Halacha Ka'acherim. He says, the Halacha Takafal is this last interpretation of the other authorities not mentioned. And now they give an example of to what extent it went. Rami Bar Choma lo izbin alei the Rabbi Nashi bar Tachlipo, the Tani Safra, the Sifrei, the Hilchasar. Okay, there was a certain Rabbi Nashi bar Tachlipo who had studied Sifra and Sifrei. Now, what is the Sifra? Sifra is the Medrash. In other words, the Torah Sheba Al Peh in this particular case, which is based upon Sefer Vayikra. I don't have to tell you that Sefer Vayikra has many, many different kinds of dinim.
All the karbonos.
Right, with the karbonos and the Beis Hamikdash, and then Taran Tumor, and the many, many things that we find over there, okay? So, he had studied the Sifra. He was a scholar of the Sifra. He knew it well. And the Sifrei is the various traditions and teachings that we have in Bamidbar and Devorah. Okay, so he was familiar with all this material, and not only that, but the Hilchasa. He had also studied, you know, actual halachas and everything else. Right? He studied all of these things. In other words, let's say he studied the Mishnah. Right? He knew all these things. He was a scholar in all these areas, and yet. What happened was that Rami Bar Choma refused to invite him, Bo Izmin, right? He refused to invite him to a mezumin when Rabbi Menashe Bar Tachlifa was sitting there at the table with him. Okay? So, in other words, why did he refuse to do it? Because of the fact that what? Lo Shimeish Talmidei Chachamim, right? In other words, he had not served, he had not apprenticed himself, so to speak, you know, to Talmidei Chachamim. He had not done that. So, in this particular case, he refused to invite him. Okay? Tanya Achemor Ma'apilu Korbe Shonu V'lo Shimish Talmidei Chachamim Asir Am Ha'oretz, right? So now, they say, I skipped a couple lines.
Yeah.
Pardon me. Okay. All right. Right, so he learned Tapra, yeah, the Sifra and the Sifra. So. Then it says, Kinoch Nafshe de Rami Bar Chona, I skipped a couple of important lines.
Yes.
When Rami Bar Chona died, Omar Rova, so Rova said concerning him, Lo Noch Nafshe de Rami Bar Chona, you know why Rami Bar Chona died? Obviously, he must have died, you know, a relatively Somebody. Young man yeah. or something like that. So, you know why he died? He died, Ela de Lo Izvin Arav Menashe Bar Tachlifa. He did not invite Rabbi Menashe bar Tachlifa, you know, to be part of the mezumen. So the Gemara asked, "Behold, Tanya, didn't we learn this beraisa just a few lines up that Acherim Omrim that you know there are others who say that Afilu Korav Shonu Shimesh Talmidei Chachamim Hareiz Am Haoretz, right? That even if he had studied Torah and had studied Mishnah, but he did not be Mishamish Talmidei Chachamim." This is the definition that he's an Amoritz, and therefore he should not be invited. So why then was Rami Bar Choma punished for not inviting him? So they say, Shani Rabbi Nashe Bar Tachlifa. He was different. Why? Because he used to serve Neshama over here is like Meshamesh, the same idea, right? Except that this is Aramaic over here, all right? So he used to be Meshamesh them. He did. He did serve them. Okay, so since he served them, then he is not to be considered an Horus. Rami Bar Choma, who the Lo Daka Basrei, and it was Rami Bar Choma who did not search out, in other words, he didn't investigate to find out whether his suspicions concerning him were truly justified or not, you know, when he refused to do it. Lishnachri, no? Or another interpretation is the Shomar Shmatu Bipumayhu the Rabbanan, all right? That he listened to all their oral Torah as they were discussing and so on, he would listen to all the conversations. So even if, let's say, he didn't serve them tea and cake or something like that, right? But nevertheless, he still was in this atmosphere of the and didn't just rely upon, you know, what he himself had learned, but he was getting from others. Okay. The Goris Lehu.
That's right.
Yeah, the Shom Mishmatu Mepani Rabbon, right, the Goris Lehu, and he learned it, so it's Ketuv Rabbon and Dovin. Then he's like, Ketuv Rabbon. All right. So now to conclude, because I see it's getting a little bit late, I'd like to conclude at 9 o'clock, the business with the Amhorets. How does the Shulchan Aruch treat it? All right, so in order to get a clue for that, we have to take a look at the print. Okay?
Okay.
First verse was on the page. Omar Abuna Halacha Kacher. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right? So it says over there, Viho Idna, but now, Ein Onu Medaktikin. We are not, literally careful. It's not the good word, however. There has to be a better word. In other words, we're not the strict, right? We're not strict in this particular area. Uregilim onu lezamein be'am horetz, and we are accustomed to invite the am horetz to join with us in the mizuzah. Okay. Kedamim mechagigo, as we say in the Gemara Chagigo, it says, Keman mekablinen ho'idnu sadusam yam horetz. According to whom, according to, you know, which authorities do we now accept Eidus? Sadusa is, you know, the Aramaic for Eidus, in other words, witness from an Amhoras, because there was a time when they felt that a person who did not understand the nature of Jewish law or anything like that, or who did not have a good reputation, whatever it may be, but they were, as we would say, posel le'edus. They were not acceptable as witnesses in any case. But the Gemara in Chagiga says that now we do accept it from the Amhoras. So who is the authority? It's commanded to Rabbi Yossi. It's in accordance with Rabbi Yossi, and he gave his reason why we do it. He says, "Kedei shelo yehei kol echad olei chadonu bomu liatzmo." It's in order that to prevent every Jewish individual from going and making an altar, an idol altar for himself. In other words, we want to have one nation, one people, observing to the best of their ability, and that's why we must not practice any exclusionary policy against the Amhoras. Invite them, have them take part in your Mizuman, have them take part in your Minyan and everything, and try to get them to learn so that they should not feel that they are excluded from Klal Yisrael. And with these words, we will
Eliminates all these other.
Yeah, right. I mean, they're all very interesting because they give us clues as to what people consider an Amhoras. One who doesn't observe this, one who doesn't observe that. And we see it ranges from such simple things, you know, as not wearing tzitzis or not putting on film, which is already an even greater issue, right?
What is the Shulchan Aruch?
The Shulchan Aruch paskens as the Tosfos over here.
Okay.
So that, you know, we do not discriminate against them. We invite them, and they're all part of the Mizuman today.
So we're still on
Mem Zion on the base. Next week, as I told you, I hope to take a couple of towards the bottom of Mem Zion. Besides attending a couple of the chasanas next week. I'll take next week off, and we'll meet in Yitz Hashem 2 weeks from tonight, immediately after Mincha Maariv. Okay.
Where are we?
I'm going to review a little bit because you missed it last week, and we had some very interesting material last week. So, yeah, Marv wasn't here either last week. So, listen, it's worth a little review. Okay? So, I'm going to start from Omar Rabbi Yossi. That would be on the I'll tell you what, I'll stop on the first big line that we have on Memchus, on Mem Zion, Oven Base. First long line there, right?
Okay. Yeah. Face. Okay.
Let's
say, yeah,
I'm doing
yeah.
a little bit reviewing right now. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm starting from the Hanochri Ein Mizam Nin Alav. You see that?
Oh yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. The Hanochri Ein Mizam Nin Alav.
This is Mem
Zion, Omid Beis, is the first long line that we have over there. Right. Yeah, towards the end, okay?
Okay.
Okay, I started actually with the quotation from the Mishnah, which is, you know, the last four words before that, okay? Hanokhri Yein Mizam Nin Olav. This is what the Mishnah had to say.
I'm not getting this.
Oi, oi, oi. Otherwise, a mitten finger.
All right. What are you saying?
Oh, you got the wrong page.
Mem Zion. Oh. Mem Zion. Well, you said you're reviewing. All right.
Okay. The Mishnah said that the Hanokhri Yein Mizam Nin Olav, that you cannot count the goy to a mezumin. So the Gemara says, Peshitta, isn't this obvious? How can you count the goy to a mezumin? So they say, Hochem in my skin, so tell me, what special case are we talking about over here in the Mishnah? The answer is, the Ger Shemol Veloy Tova. We're talking about a Ger, in other words, he was a convert to Judaism who was circumcised, but he had not yet gone into the Mikveh, not yet immersed himself in the Mikveh. The Omer Rabbi Zera, Omer Rabbi Yochanan, as Rabbi Zera said in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, he says, L'Yoylam Eino Ger, a person is not 100% a convert, you know, truly a ger, ad sheyomol v'yitbol, until he has been circumcised and he has immersed himself in the mikveh. The kamo delei toval, and as long as he has not yet immersed himself in the mikveh. The Mishnah had said that noshim avodim iktanuim zamna aleihem, right? That you cannot count to a mezumen women, or slaves, or minors. You cannot count them. Last week I spent a great deal of time in talking about what is the status of slaves, the Eved Ivri, and the Eved Kanani, and I pointed out that in either case they are actually Jews, because even an Eved Kanani who is born a non-Jew, the first act that the master has to do once he comes under his control is to have him circumcised and to have him immersed in the mikveh, and then he counts as a Jew. He's liable to all the mitzvahs that you know, a Jew is liable to perform, with the exception of mitzvahs asur shehazman groh, you know, those affirmative commandments that are dependent upon time, that he is not liable for. That's why? Because he has to serve his master. Just as we excuse women from doing it, not that we want to say that women and slaves are exactly on an equal status, they're not. But, I mean, we already saw that there was a big difference. That, for example, we said that women, noshim yesh lehen deos, in other words, they have opinions, their mind works, they can think, and that's the reason why women are permitted to make a mezumen for themselves. But they are not allowed to be counted to a mezumen, you know, if you have mixed group. Why not? So the answer that Gemara gave at that time was pritzusa. They wanted to discourage any occasion for immorality, and this is the reason why they discourage counting them to the mezumen. Okay? But as far as slaves are concerned, they're essentially, it's because their time is their master's time, and that's the reason. Okay, but now we're talking, now the Gemara goes, now that they've discussed the women and the slaves, now they're ready to discuss minors, ketanim, where we said that they cannot be counted to mezumen. So here we're going to see that there are different opinions among the rabbis as to whether there are circumstances under which we can count a minor. And we'll see some very interesting Gemaras. Okay. First of all, Omer Rabbi Yossi said, Koten Hamutal Barisa, if you have a young child who is still lying in his crib, Mizamnin Olav, then you can count him to a mezumen. Now, I don't want to say that this becomes the halacha, it wasn't accepted. But it's interesting that he felt that if there were two adults and there was a child, a boy in the house, even though this child was very, very young yet, so you can count them in order to enable people to bench with the mezuzah. So that was Rabbi Yossi's opinion. All right? The Hotanan, so they object and they say, look, didn't we learn in the Mishnah that Noshim Avonim Mekatanim, that women, slaves, and young children, right? Ein Mezamnin Alav, you're not allowed to count them to the Mezuman. So the answer is that Rabbi Yossi had an opinion similar to another authority. Who the Yomak Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi? He was of the opinion of what Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi had said. Dama Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi, who Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi said, Apal Pisham Ru Kotana Mutaba Risa in Mizamnan Alav. Even though they said that if you have a young child who lies in the crib, you're not allowed to count him to the Mizuman. But he says you can make him literally like a joint member to ten. In other words, Taka, according to Rabbi Shimon Levi, you cannot count, you know, such a young child to a mezuman. But if you're desperate for a minion, then in that particular case, you can make him a sniff la'azara, as I say, like sniff. A twig. In other words, like a joint member to the minion. Okay. So, Omer Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi,
branch,
huh?
Branch.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah.
Dolar.
Yeah, right, branch, right. Yeah, we use them to set a branch, in the, exactly. Yeah. So, you can see how all these words that the Gemara uses have become revived in modern Hebrew, various capacities. Yeah. The Omer Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi, in another statement of Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi, he said, Tisha b'Yevin. If you have 9 full-fledged people and you have a slave, then it's tarfin. The slave can be counted to the minion. So Meisvei, on this, they raised an objection. The objection comes to the Gemara in Gittin, where it says, Matzav Rabbi Eliezer, this is a story about Rabbi Eliezer. It happened once, Shenichnas Leveis HaKnesses. Rabbi Eliezer came to shul in order to daven. Below Motza Asorah, and he did not find that there were 10 people over there. So the Shichrer Abdo, what did he do?
When the young he,
No. You're anticipating, but this is not the story yet. The Shichrer Abdo, he freed his slave. He emancipated him.
Man,
yeah.
He
made him a free man. The Yishlim Ola Asor, and they were then able to complete the minyan as a result. So the Gemara deduces from this story what? Shichrer in, that if Itaka freed his slave, he gave him full freedom, then in that particular case, then the slave definitely could be counted to the minyan. But lo shichrer, lo. But what happened if he did not actually emancipate a slave? Then in that case, he could not be counted to the minyan. Alright? This is what the Gemara assumes. So they say, it's terichu. We need this for different cases. Shichrer chad, v'nofik bechad. We're talking about where he freed one slave, and they needed an additional one in order to make up 10. So, all right, guns fine. Somehow, rather, Reb Shur ben Levi, you know, based on the story of Rabbi Eliezer and so on, figured out that in that case, if you have 9, and you can count one other somehow by hook or by crook. Right? In that case. So, and therefore, he assumes then that what happened in the case of Rabbi Eliezer was that even if they were short 2 to the minyan, he freed the slave, so that made him 9. Numbered 9, and then you could go ahead and count number 10 somehow by the hook and the crook method, as we'll see. As, for example, a miner who's lying in the crib, right? In order to help make a minyan. But at this, they raised an objection. Mora, pardon me?
They're in bad shape, they can't make a minion.
Yeah. Even in those days, they had trouble making a minion.
Feel a little better.
Right. So now the Gemara says, V'hechi Yomid Hochi. How could Rabbi Eliezer have freed his slave? How could he have acted this way? So Omar Rabbi Yehuda, didn't Rabbi Yehuda say, Kol ham shachver abdo over ba'aseh? Anyone who frees a slave is violating an affirmative commandment. What is that commandment? Shenemar, there's a pasuk in the Torah speaking about the Eved Kanani who is sold and becomes a Jewish slave. Okay? It's written over there that in that case, the Olam Bahem Ta'avodah, that you should always have mastery over them. In other words, what? You're not allowed to free your Eved Kanani, right?
Mm.
This is the implication. The way he takes the meaning of the pasuk. The Olam Bahem Ta'avodah means you should always have mastery over them. Mm. You should always be the masters over them. They should be a slave. So I pointed out, there are exceptions. Exception is that, for example, if you take the Yevet Kanani and Yehakimois, Tuv, Yehakimois, an eye, or anything like that, a finger, a toe, you name it, okay? What we call Roshei Avorim, in other words, the principal limbs in the body. Needless to say, if Yehakimois, Hafus, and so on, I mean, you name it, okay?
Right.
But any principal limb in the body, if you Hakimois, then in that case, the slave automatically goes free. Even though he's an Eved Kanani. I mean, you're not allowed to treat your slaves in that particular way, you see. So in that case, the Bezdin frees the slave. Now again, I reiterate, we're not talking about the Eved Ivri. The Eved Ivri, as I said, he was a Jew, a full-fledged Jew, who did what? He sold himself into slavery because he couldn't pay his debts, or else he had stolen. He had squandered whatever he had stolen, therefore he could not make restitution. And if he couldn't make restitution, then the Beis Din had the power to sell him into slavery until he worked off, the debt that he owed. Okay? And of course, at any time, an Eved Ivri could gain his freedom by paying off what was owed. In other words, if the master estimated, that the services came, let's say, to 6 shkolim, okay? Once they paid off the 6 shkolim, then he gained his freedom automatically. But this was not the case in the Eved Kanani, because the Eved Kanani was supposed to remain in servitude, okay? All right, I mean, today, thank God, we don't have slavery, period. But we're talking about, to
not
understand
here,
the
not
positive,
in this
right?
part of the world.
Yeah.
I don't understand. The Eved Kanani became...
Yeah. He became Jewish, right.
So why then should... Why then should we serve us?
Have a distinction.
Because the pasuk says, the Olam Bahem Ta'avodah. In other words,
you can keep
them as perpetual slaves. That you can do.
But not them anymore.
You don't like it? Don't have kindness to me. I'm telling you what the pasuk says. Yes.
I don't mean to take issue with you, but I would have thought that this would mean an Eved Kanani like those that faced B'nai Israel when they came into the land, that they were, after they were conquered, they either paid tribute or they did what the
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about, right? The Milchemes Rishus and so on. I mean, this is what we read in last week's Seder.
But in this case, the cases are distinguished because this is a man who has become a Jew. He's not now there. It's not a...
Yeah, correct.
Here.
Correct.
So why should the same Pika, why should the same...
The point is that even the Eved Ivri, as long as the Eved Ivri was still in servitude to his master, so he is still an Eved, and in that case it would be the same story as if he were an Eved Kanani. But as I said, the difference is that the Eved Ivri gains his freedom either by redemption, right? Penis Atzmos, we would say. So an early Mishnah that we had in Kedushin, that he can gain his freedom either by paying off, right? Or if he has, served for 6 years, then in that case he gets a shonim, as we say.
Right.
In other words, by the amount automatically, when the seventh year comes, he's automatically free, right? Or if the Yovel comes, in which case also he becomes free. Okay?
Right, let me try this a different way.
What's
Yovel?
Yovel is Jubilee. Every 50th year is a Jubilee. Okay?
Let me try this a different way.
Yeah.
The Eved Kanani becomes an Eved Ivri. Doesn't he?
No, technically no.
But, really?
Technically, the answer is no.
Not, but I mean, in a practical sense, you have one evidy, three who came in through maybe a court order or whatever.
Yeah.
And you had another who came in because
he was conquered.
He was sold. He was sold into
slavery.
Both
of them before you were evidy. Yeah.
But I think the distinction is that the Ephraim is a Jew by choice. The Evanani is really a Jew forced into Judaism because he's a slave to a Jew.
Yeah, that's not a bad distinction.
That's
not a bad distinction.
He may not want to have been a Jew, but as long as he's a slave of Jewish master, he is forced to be circumcised. As Phil explained, and he is forced to become a Jew and be accountable for the mitzvot.
Right.
He may not want it.
I mean, how do we know that you have to circumcise him? Because it's written in the Torah in connection with Pesach, if you'll take a look, towards the end of the 12th chapter in Shmos, okay? It's written over there, you know, that the Eved is not allowed to partake in the Korban Pesach until it's written Umalto Oso Oz Yochalbo, that once you circumcise him, then in that particular case he's permitted to eat of it. So from this we learn already that the Eved, even if he's an Eved Kanani, but once it becomes the property of a Jew, then in that particular case he has to be circumcised. And of course, as we saw over here, he's not a Jew until what?
Until he goes
to the mikveh. So that these both acts, you know, had to be carried out. And this was done, of course, either by his master or by the Beis Din, either one. But I don't want to belabor the point too much. If you remember the beginning of Mishpatim, it's written over there, Ki Sikna Eved Ivri, right? When you purchase an Eved Ivri, then it says, Sheshonim Yavei, you know, 6 years he has Shloim, and so on. Okay. The Medrash, Mechilta, which is the halachic Medrash on that part of the Torah, raises the question, how do we understand the word Eved Ivri? Do we understand it in the sense of Eved Ivri, namely that the Eved himself is an Ivri? Or do we mean Eved Shel Ivri? In other words, the slave of a Jew. In which case, of course, and in that case, we might say then that the same law should apply to the Eved Kanani, namely that after serving 6 years he goes free.
Right.
So therefore, that's why they take the other pasuk, they say, Le'olam b'hem ta'avodu, you know, that you're to have them as slaves in perpetuity, in order to prove the fact that Eved Ivri means literally a Hebrew slave and has nothing to do with the slave owned by a Jew. Okay? So they do make this distinction. As I say, this is the law of the Torah. It doesn't mean we're going to reinstitute slavery. I'm sure that we can have, if Mashiach comes, we'll be able to free everybody. And we'll all live in freedom. Halavai
Amen.
All right. But at any rate, getting back to our story. All right. So as we see, he's being critical of the action of Rabbi Eliezer in freeing his slave in order to be able to help make up a minyan, right?
Apparently it was an Eved Kanani.
Yeah, this was an Eved Kanani, obviously, right? Matter of fact, they tell different stories. This is the famous story about Rabbi Eliezer, the one that's quoted over here. Rabbi Gamliel, who was the head of the Sanhedrin in his time, he had another Eved by the name of Tabi. This Tabi was very devoted to him, very firm in everything else. And, finally he gave Tabi his freedom. And again, you know, the same question. Under what circumstances could it be possible to do it? This is what we're going to see. Under what circumstances? Okay? So, all right. So remember, Rabbi Yehuda said that Kolam Shachar Abdo, right? Whoever frees his slave is over Basi, right? He violates the affirmative command Shenema, which says Le'olam Behem Tabod, that you are to have mastery over them in perpetuity. And he says, so how come that Rabbi Eliezer, who presumably knew Torah very well, how could he do such a thing? So they say the Dvar Mitzvah Shani. We say it's different in order to perform a mitzvah, right? But, again, an objection is raised. Are we to say that every time you perform a mitzvah, therefore you have carte blanche to commit a violation, right? To commit a violation, right? To do an aveira? And that's exactly the objection. They say, mitzvah habo ba'averahi. Hey, this is a mitzvah which comes about as a result of an aveira. Right? And there's a general principle that we have mentioned in various places in the Talmud that say that mitzvah habor ba'avera, that any mitzvah which comes about as a result of a sin is lab mitzvah. It's not a mitzvah. Don't gain a mitzvah, you know, by committing an avera and then turning into a mitzvah. Okay? It's not a mitzvah.
If that was the case, you get right to shul on Shabbos.
Of course, of course. But, you know, they're really concerned with other things, though. I mean, if a person, for example, would steal money and then use the money in order to give to charity, okay? From the Jewish point of view, even though we say that giving charity is tremendous mitzvah, but if it's stolen money, that's mitzvah bo ba'avera. That's wrong.
A wonderful point is that.
Yeah. So, again, the question is, so how could Rabbi Eliezer have done such a thing? So the Gemara says, mitzvah the Rabim Shani, a mitzvah which benefits more than just one person, but it benefits the community, this already is a little bit different. Well, I don't mean that therefore you should rob and give to the United Jewish Appeal or something like that. Say that that's
what does that mean exactly? That
but the point is, mitzvah the Rabim over here, you're benefiting not only Rabbi Eliezer, who wants to daven Mincha or Mayrav or Shacharis, whatever it is, but you're actually helping out the entire congregation. Everybody who was there, they all wanted to participate in the mitzvah of davening with a minyan. And so therefore, this was permissible as a result.
What does the word shani mean?
Shani means different.
Different?
Yeah, it's different.
Different.
Right. Shani is Aramaic. In Hebrew, you say shoneh. Shoneh. One of the meanings of the word shoneh in Hebrew is that it's different.
Shani is Aramaic.
Right. Right.
I see.
Okay,
so
now we have another statement of Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi. Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi says, "L'yodim yashkim odom leveis haknesses." A man should always arise early, be among the first to get to shul. Why? K'day sheyiskev yimoneh masor rishonim, so that he should be worthy enough to be counted among the first 10 people who come to shul. Why? Sha'afilu meyo boyim achra, because if even 100 then show up after him, Kibel alav schar kula, he has received unto himself the reward for all of them. So they say, schar kulam salpatach. How can you say that he gets the reward for everybody who's in the shul? Eloheimo, but rather we are to understand that it's meaning, nosten lo sochar, that they give him reward, keneged kulam, which is in the amount, in the quantity, the reward, as the reward that all the others who came in afterwards, you know, get. So if you're among the first 10 people, remember that you get a special reward from the Rebbeinu Shalom for helping to do that. Okay?
Where does it fit now, for example, the importance of the minyan, or if a person, let's say, can daven himself, and he davens Mircha, and he davens Marit. Now we have...
Okay.
Without the minyan, I know he doesn't say Kedusha, he doesn't say...
Correct, correct. You can't say a Kaddish. Yeah.
You can't say a Kaddish.
Certain things, as we say, the mitzvah, the rabbim, I mean, these things, you know, that you cannot do without a minyan. Okay?
Right.
All right. Now, do you want to know what is the difference between them?
Well, I'm saying now, you're faced with no minyan.
Yeah,
and the importance that's being projected here about
exactly the
exactly
importance of
he's
with
attempting
a minyan.
To even to go
exactly.
to a subterfuge with the greatest lengths to make a minyan
exactly.
But
right.
let's say he couldn't make a minyan, and they were only 8 people.
Yeah,
but if
there are only 8 people, I mean, then they'd have them for themselves. I mean,
they'd have them for themselves.
Right, exactly.
Anyway, so
okay,
all right.
But it's considered, you know, a greater mitzvah if you can make a minyan so that you can say all these extra things, you know, that you can't do if you don't have a minyan.
Now you see that the point where a man, why would he go to subterfuges, you know, and so forth, when ultimately he could just step back and dominate his...
this is correct, Sam. But on the other hand, the desire to be part of a community and dominating as part of a community, to dominate with a minion and to the Dovish of the Kedusha.
Right. But not to go to a subterfuge, that's what I'm saying. It's clearly a subterfuge to say, well, he's going to free his slave. Let's say
he's going to count
just because
count a little baby.
No, we understand. But nevertheless, you can see how great is the desire in order to promote
a minion.
A minion.
Oh, sure.
But is this necessarily a halacha?
Not to count the baby, no. But we're not finished yet with this, because we have several more things to learn over here, okay? All right, and now here's the next one, the one that you already had heard in the past, over Rav Huna. Rav Huna said that Tisha V'Oron Mitznofen, he says that there are nine people, then they can be counted together with the Oron Kodesh to make a minyan. And this, of course, I don't have to tell you, it's a little difficult to understand. So, Rav Nachman said, Aron Gavrahu, tell me, is the Aron Kodesh a man that you can be counted? You can be counted. But rather, what Rav Huna meant was, Tisha Nirin Kasora, if nine people in the shul look as though they are a minion, they look like ten, then in that case they can be added. Okay, so Amre Lo, so there are those who say, how do nine look like ten? So one opinion is Kime Kanfe, right? If they are close together. If you see nine people close together, you have the illusion already that
there might be an extra
there are ten, okay? The Amre Lo, but there are those who say on the contrary, it's Kime Vadre. When these people are scattered, there's one here, one there, one there, one there, so it looks like all the pews are occupied over there. Omer Rabbi Ami said, Shnayim v'Shabbos, if you have two people, and it's Shabbos, then it's Torfin, then they can be counted to a mezuman. There are only two people at the table, right? Mm-hmm. But it's Shabbos, then you count Shabbos as being the third one, okay? Omele Rav Nachman, so Rav Nachman said to him, Shabbos Gavrahu, tell me,
again,
is Shabbos a man? Elo Omer Rabbi Ami, but rather Rabbi Ami said, Shnei Talmidei Chachomim, if you have two Talmidei Chachomim over there, and Hamechadadin Zezeb Halacha, and each one sharpens the other with halachic discussions, so that they go at it with full zest, then in that case, Mitztarfen. Then they can be counted as if they were a mezuman. I guess because there's so many different opinions that are being, that you figure. One opinion per person is enough, but if you have 10 opinions here, 10 opinions over there, so that calls somebody for at least a mezuman. The Chaver Rachmistos explained, he says, Kegoin Anov Rav Sheshes. Yeah, like for example, me and Rav Sheshes, if we're together, we can sort of be like a mezuman because we're always discussing time. The Chaver Rav Sheshes, and so Rav Sheshes returned the compliment. He says, yeah, could go on the Rav Chista, yeah, like me and Rav Chista. Okay. They're very nice to each other. Complimenting each other.
They take up space in the Gemara. Good compliments.
Now Rabbi Yochanan. Now along comes Rabbi Yochanan.
Oh boy.
This is again in connection with the idea of the katan. What kind of a katan? What kind of a minor can be counted? So it says, Koton Poreach, Mizamnen Alav. A Koton who is literally blossoming forth, in other words, he's beginning to show signs of puberty, so he can be counted. Tanyana Mihochi, and we have a similar Baraisa which teaches that Koton, Shehevi Shtei Saros, that if you have a young boy, a minor boy who has already produced two hairs, in other words, two hairs in the pubic region, right? So mizamnin alav, then he could be included in the mizum. But v'shalohei shtei saros, but if he has not yet produced any hairs, then im mizamnin alav, then he cannot be counted to the mizumin. But he says v'im medaktikin bekotan. But you don't go asking him to lower his pants in order to examine to see whether. So in other words, if he looks as though he should be
about 13 or something like that, then in that particular case you can count him. But if he doesn't look like it, then in that particular case you can't count him.
So if he looks grown up, you use him.
Yeah.
If he doesn't look grown up, you don't use him.
Exactly.
That's basically the rule. Yeah.
If this went back far enough, maybe they don't even keep the records, like the accuracy of the age of the birth.
Well, this is true, but still people in general had an idea about the age. Because if they didn't insist, you know, the majority begins at the age of 13 in the day, in the case of a boy, in the case of a girl, at 12 in the day, and so on. How would you know? But obviously, you know, then you would only rely upon physical simonim. If a girl begins to develop breasts, or she begins to menstruate, and so on, you know, then particularly the breast development which precedes menstruation normally, okay? So that makes her already a gadola, okay? And in the case of a boy, when he develops pubic hair, so in that particular case, we say that he's already reached a stage of puberty. But for us, it's a lot easier to do it simply on the basis of keeping track of birthdays. So then they say, oh, gufa kasha, hey, this in itself is a kasha, what you're telling me over there. Amrit Avishtesars. First of all, you say that if he has produced two hairs, right? In. And in that case, yes, you can count them, right? Lo Havi, and if he didn't, lo, then he can't be counted, right? And then you tell me another thing, and you say, hey, the doctor can be cotton. You're not that exacting, you know, to examine, you know, what kind of a cotton is he, right? So, what are you including over here when you say you don't, you know, you don't examine that carefully? So they say, my love, la suye cotton perea, aren't you, what you're saying is, in order to include what they said before, the cotton perea, namely a young boy who is already beginning to show signs of blossoming, in other words, this is what you mean, right? That you don't examine him that closely if you can see signs. I mean, let's say if he already has a few hairs on his chin, that you could see. So in that particular case, you know, you can figure out. All right, let's take a look at the Rashi on the top over there. Let's see a cotton paraf, right? He says, Shame a doctor can vote. You don't look upon him. If he has already reached the age of years, in other words, you know, 13 in a day, or not. Mahain shanim. And what do we mean by shanim? By shanim we mean yud gimel shanim yomecha, right? In other words, 13 years and one day. Once he has already started, you know, the, you know, he's already reached the age of his 13th birthday plus another day, which means that he's already now started his 14th year. Understand, right? So in that case, that's it. So then, imedaktikin, in other words, if we know that he's reached this age, then we don't start to look for other physical evidence as to whether he can be counted. Mm. All right. Anyway, the Gemara concludes by saying, but the halacha does not follow all these different discussions that we've had, but rather, it follows a different story. The Omer Rav Nachman, Rav Nachman said, "Koton hayodei alamim avorchim v'omnulo." If a boy knows to whom we are reciting our brachas, in other words, he understands well the concept of God and why we should be grateful to God and something like that, then in that case, he says, we are permitted to add him to the mezuzah. And they give the story of Abaye v'Rava. Abaye v'Rava havi yasvei kamei d'Rabbo. They were sitting in the presence of Rabbo. Omalu Rabbo, so Rabbi said unto them, Lemim Mevorchin, who is it that we recite our brachas to? So Amr Lei, they said to him, the Rachmona. We recite them to the Rachman. In other words, you know, God, the All Merciful. You know, like a Rachman we say in the benching. Mm-hmm. Okay? The Rachmona Hecha Yatsiv. So then he asked the following question. Tell me, where does the All Merciful dwell? So Rava Achbe Lishmeitullah, Rava pointed to the ceiling, okay? Abaye Nofak Lebrua, Abaye went outside, Achbe Klapeshwai, and he pointed to the sky, the heavens. Omalu Rava, So Rava said to them, "Tavaychu rabbanan habidu. The day will come when both of you become rabbis. Einu de'amrei inche, butzim butzim mikata yedim." This is then the proverb that people say that all kinds of gourds can be understood. You can recognize them, you know, by the stalk from which they are derived. In other words, as we said in Yiddish, you know, the apple popped right from the bloom. And as a result, you know, we can see that these two boys, by virtue of the answers that they gave, are destined to be great scholars at when they grow. All right. Now we continue. This is as far as I got last week, by the way. So now we're going into new material. So Rabbi Yehuda said, in the name of Rabbi Shmuel Bar Shailas, Mishmei the Rav, in the name of Rav. All right, so Rav is the ultimate source of this. And he says, Tisha Ochlu Doga. If nine people sat and they ate grain products, in other words, they ate bread, okay? In the course of the meal. V'yechod Ochal Yerek, right?
What's
but
yarek?
One ate only vegetables. He didn't eat any meat, any bread, in other words, okay? So mitzvah. Nevertheless, we say that the ten, you know, all ten of them can be counted to the
minyan.
Okay? Of course, we're talking now at, you know, benching.
Right.
It's understood. Okay? Amar Rav Zeira. So Rav Zeira said when he heard this, Boy in my name, Rav Yehuda. He says, you know, I asked Rav Yehuda the following question. I said, Shmona Mahu, what if you have eight who ate bread and two who didn't? Shiva Mahu, what if you had only seven who ate bread and the other three didn't? They ate, but they didn't eat any bread. Can they be counted to the mezuzah? Omalei Leishna. So he said to him, it makes no difference. In other words, if we're sitting at the table, let's say at our breakfast table, and let's say nine of us wash, we eat, we have a roll, or whatever it may be that we're eating over there, and the tenth one only has a cup of coffee even, technically, okay? Or he eats a jelly donut, whatever it may be. But particularly, you know, we're talking about something which isn't even doggone, okay? Nevertheless, that person can be counted to the minion as long as he's eaten something. Okay? He can count
him. Even though he didn't wash.
Right, even though he didn't wash. But the point is, he can be counted to the minion, so that somebody can say, you know, Rabbeisai, right?
Mishus
Mon Rabbeisai, Nevo Echel, Keino Shechal
Mishalom. Okay? But he wouldn't recite the Birkat HaMazon, he would just be counted.
Correct, correct. He should recite the proper bracha for what he is eating.
Yeah.
In other words, I mean, if you're right, Shehakol, you know, so he would say in the foshes or something like that.
Can he respond?
He can respond.
Respond,
that's the point, right?
The
right.
Birkat.
Yeah. The Gemara does give an alternate. We had a few pages back that it's possible for this person, for example, instead of saying, you know, Baruch Lekeinu Shachal Mishlo, you say Baruchum Baruch Shemo Tomid Liyolom Boved, okay? So that's sort of like an answer to it. But the point is, you can make a minyan for, you know, purposes of benching with this person. So even through seven, we say there's no question that they would count.
Yeah.
All right. So then he says, Shisha Vadei Levin Boyli. But six, I certainly did not ask him. So I'm only Rabbi Zeira. So Rabbi Zeira said, when he heard this, he said, Shapir about it. You really did the right thing, Deloi Boy Lecha. Because that you did not ask, you know, what about six? Why? Hosam Tamav Mai. What is the reason why, in the case of the nine, the eight, the seven, it's Mishum de Ika Rubo? Is that the reason? Because we still have a majority of eaters? So Hochanami Karuba. So even in the case of six, it still would create a ruba. They still are a majority. So the the Ihu Sovar, and he was of the opinion what the ruba the min kabeina, that the majority which can be recognized as the majority we require. But he felt that in the case of only six, then in that particular case there weren't enough. Now, I do have to tell you that, you know, you have different opinions about exactly this. we have the problem on a fast day, okay? It's mincha time. How many do you need in a minyan of fasters in order to be able to read the Torah, you know, to read Vayechal, to say Sim Shalom and the Birkas Kohanim and so on and so forth? You understand?
I assume there would be 10.
Huh? All right. The ideal is, of course, 10. It's better if we have a minyan where at least 10 people have been fasting. Okay? This is the ideal. But what would happen if you had 8 fasters? You had 7 fasters? You understand? Can you still do it? The answer is yes. How about 6? You'd say no, based on this, right?
Mm-hmm.
We paskin, nevertheless, that even if you had 6, since they are a ruba, and you can see that they are still a recognizable majority, so in that particular case, we could be counted. Why? Again, because we're anxious to do the right thing. We're anxious to read from the Torah on the fast day. We're anxious to say the extra prayers that we have to recite, you know, like Aneinu, and the fact that we say Sim Shalom and the Birkas Kohanim, you know, these are things that we say.
What if you had the person who had fasted to that point, so you were legal, and you, you know, but then later on he broke fast, but it still would not matter to the situation. You could
if
still
at the
one.
Time when he had eaten, Minta, he had not yet eaten. In that case,
he was
still
okay.
Fast.
Yeah. So, the fact that he broke it fast is his own personal
error. In the morning, though, let's say.
In the morning, hopefully, we'll get more people.
In the morning, they can say, well, they haven't eaten so far.
Thank God here at Kadima, we do quite well, I mean, when it comes to fast days. I don't know. But still, there are times when we just about scrape by. So this is the justification for it, okay? That rubah, the min kor de'inan. And you see, it's accepted as a fact, because this is the accepted halacha, that as long as you can recognize the fact that there is a rove, that there is a majority, then in that particular case, you can
permitted.
Count it as a minyan. Yanai Malko, now we have a very interesting story. Yanai Malko, King Yanai, Malkaso, and his queen, Kiricha Rivta Bahade Hadode. They were, you know, they were having a meal. Kiricha Rivta means literally they were making like a sandwich with their bread, but we don't have to take it in its literal meaning. What it means is that they were having dinner, okay? They were having dinner. And when they slew the rabbis, this is the Gemara that we find in Zohar and other places, that Yanai Malko, King Alexander Yanai, he hated the Pharisees, he hated the Prussians, he hated the rabbis, because they wouldn't give in to him and things that he wanted. And so what did he do? In his great anger, because they wouldn't, you know, give a kind of a judgment. They wanted to judge a person who was his close friend, because that person had violated all kinds of laws. And Alexander Yanai wanted to protect his pal. So he told them, you know, he threatened them that they'd better come up with the right verdict, or else. So they said, we cannot transgress the law. The law is this and this and this and this, and we're not going to do it. So in his anger, he killed them all. Okay.
That was the Orels.
Yeah, that was the Orels. He killed them.
Wow.
Right. Now, one rabbi was left alive.
No, murder.
That was Shimon ben Shetach. Why was he left alive? Because he happened to be the queen's brother.
Wow.
So this is what we're dealing with over here. Okay? The Mekot Elohul Rabbanon, right? So after he slew the rabbis, after he killed them, the Havalei Inish the Bruch Elohul. So there was no one who would bench for him. Because obviously, while he was, you know, a powerful king, but apparently, Agresa Talmud Chochem, he wasn't. And he wanted somebody to bench for him. But there may have been another reason, too. Do you remember several pages back, we had a question, who makes Hamotzi? And we said that it's preferable that the Balabayas makes it. Why? So they said, because then he'll be generous in giving to everybody, and so on. And who leads the benching? So they said, the guest leads the benching. Why does a guest lead the benching? Not because the Baal HaBayis is incapable, but if you remember, we had a very beautiful bracha that they added in honor of the Baal HaBayis. May God send them good years and prosperity and give them Olam Haba and everything else and so on. So that therefore it was customary to ask the guest, you know, to come and to recite, you know, to lead in the grace after meals.
Right.
Okay? All right. So let's say even if he were, you know, capable of knowing how to make Birkas HaMazon, I'll grant him that. After all, it's Fault Ayid, even if it was a murderous Jew. Okay? So, but at any rate, he wanted, you know, to have his brother-in-law, Shimon ben Shetach, bless him. All right, lead the bench. Omar Lord and Vishu. So, he said to his wife, Man Yahavilan Gavra, the Mevorech Lon, who can give me a man who will recite the bracha for us? So, Omar Lay. So she said unto him, Ishtabali the Maisinim Lachol Gavil Ben Misazulay. Promise me, she said, that if I bring you a man who can do it, that you will not afflict him. In other words, you won't put him in jail, you won't persecute him, you won't kill him. So Ishtabal. So he gave her his promise. I Sisilishim Ben Shetach Achuva. So she brought to him Shem Ben Shetach, her brother. See, Shem ben Shetach had hidden himself. This is the reason why he was not killed with the others. It wasn't that Yanai wanted to spare him, but he had been hidden. And now she produced him with the promise, you know, that Yanai would not persecute him any further. Okay? Osve ben Yidele Didoa. And what did they do? They sat him down between him and her. Omale. So he said to him, Chaziz kami yekor avidnulo, says, look what great honor I'm showing you. The fact that where did I put you? This position of honor, right? Between me, the king, and you know, my queen. Or Malay, so he said to him, Lavat komokert li, el oraisa v'dimokfer li. He says, you know, it is not your honor which is being bestowed upon me, but rather is the Torah that brings me honor. The Tziv, as it is written, it seems to be a pasuk in Mishnah, in the book of Proverbs, says, Sal Salah, if you will, you know, handle it beautifully, then it will raise you. Techabdech, it will give you honor. If you embrace it. Of course, what they're talking about over there is wisdom. Not sure which wisdom we're talking about, the wisdom of the Torah. So that if you embrace it, then in that particular case, it will bring you to honor. Yanai was not happy with what his brother-in-law said. Omalei said to him, and who did he say to? He said to his wife, obviously. He says, Kochaziz telo mekabel borus. Take a look and you see how he does not willingly accept my authority over him. In other words, he begrudges me the fact that I am king over him. No, okay, that was the remark he made. Then, Yahavu lei kosel avruche. So then they brought a cup of wine for him, you know, to recite the benching of. Remember that, you know, this was the customary thing, that you would bench over a cup of wine. Omar, heichi avrit. So what did Shem ben Shetach say? He said, tell me, what kind of a bracha should I make? Should I say the bracha Boros She'ochal Yanai V'Chaveiro Mishalo? Blessed be God, from whose bounty Yanai and his companions have eaten. In other words,